The internet seems to be at the very core of almost everything we do today. It's hard to imagine a time when it wasn't available. To become this pervasive meant turning the internet, and more importantly the web, into an information fabric that can be grasped and utilized by the common man. Today's guest has long been involved with making the internet accessible to people in all walks of life. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Terry Crowley, a technical fellow and director of development for Microsoft Office. I hope you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code. After graduating from MIT in 1982, Terry worked for over 10 years at BBN Labs. From there, he went to work for Banyan Systems and Beyond Mail. He then hired into Vermeer just before that company and its core product, FrontPage, was acquired by Microsoft. Today, he is a director of Office development, focusing on the next version of Office, Office 14. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Terry Crowley. Okay. Now, Terry, all of us working at Microsoft here, at some point in time, got that bug. You know, the little technology bug that, you know, forces us into computers and programming or whatever. Where did you first get involved in technology?
Well, my dad was actually very involved in computers. He actually wrote a book, Understanding Computers. But I didn't really get involved in computers just barely in high school. You know, we did a little basic programming. Everybody had the paper tape, the punt that you fed into the computer back then. But it really wasn't until I went to MIT, and I was originally going to be a chemical engineer.
That's kind of different. Chemical engineer and programming, it's
very different, very different. But I took an introductory computer course there. It was given by Joseph Weizenbaum, and I sort of got the bug there. He wrote a book called Human Power and Computer Power and Human Reason, and there was one line from that book that I think captured really what got me excited, and it was something like, no general has ever commanded more power than a computer programmer programming his environment, his world.
So you're a power fiend, in other words.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's all about control.
So from there, you switched from being a chemical engineer to being a computer programmer. Did that happen instantly, or did over a year or so, or?
Well, I took that first course in the freshman year, and I actually sort of found I was pretty good at it. And then that summer, I got an internship at Bell Laboratories, which is where my dad worked as well. And that was my first introduction to programming in C and getting a lot of experience with Unix. And sort of I got excited. I found I was pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. And so when I went back in the sophomore year, that's the direction I took, and I got much more involved in computer classes at that point.
So I bet your dad was pretty happy that you were following his footsteps, kind of.
I think he was pretty excited to see me sort of go down that path.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I understand you actually come from a rather large family.
So there's 14 kids in the family, 7 boys and 7 girls.
I have a hard time grasping that in my head. I mean, because you were kind of on the younger side, weren't you?
I was the 10th. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there was the old kids, or the big kids and the little kids, and I was on the little kid side.
Yeah. Now, how many of your siblings then went into computers and technology?
So, a bunch of them went into my 2 younger brothers also went to MIT.
It's kind of funny talking about your siblings. A bunch of them.
A bunch of them. 2 younger brothers went to MIT and were into computers. It's actually my youngest brother who's still, I think, actively programming. He's probably the only one who's actively programming besides myself. And then some of my older brothers who got into some more business analyst type of programming. But there's a few doctors and lawyers and CFOs and other people, disciplines or professions in that crowd.
Now, in your early days, you worked at BBN Systems, where you worked on this program called Slate.
Yeah.
What exactly was that?
So Slate was a multimedia document system, is what we called it. And so it was basically a word processing system where you could put spreadsheets and graphics and images and audio clips in it, and it was also sort of connected to email, so I could email these rich documents around. It started off as a project called Diamond that was funded by DARPA.
And this was, what year was this about?
So Diamond was in 83, 84, and then as that project was initially funded by DARPA and NSF, and then we turned it into a commercial product called Slate, mm-hmm. In the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So when I first joined BBN, I had a workstation that had a 200 megabyte hard disk, and I think it was probably another 12 years or so before I had a hard disk that big on an actual PC.
During this time, especially since you mentioned, like, you know, emailing with Slate and stuff like that, the internet was really kind of an undercurrent for computers. Yeah. Stuff like that. A lot of people were using the internet for doing FTP and file transfer and access and stuff like that, long before the general public really understood what the internet was. And so you were kind of involved in some of that internet development stuff.
Well, so BBN was one of the sort of core developers of the internet. You know, and the people I worked with were involved with that. I worked with Ray Tomlinson, who famously is the guy who picked the at symbol for email, and he actually, it turned out, he wrote the first intermachine email program, and I worked with him for 10 years. A fabulous engineer. And Ginny Travers, who I worked with very closely, wrote the first internet router. So that, you know, I was definitely very, very close to them. I was on some of the internet task forces, and you interacted with, you know, some of the famous names. John Postel was someone I worked with quite a bit, and he was sort of very, very famous in the internet development.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, did you comprehend that the internet would become as ubiquitous as it is today?
It's kind of funny. I think there was, the people who were involved definitely felt this is different. This is, people just don't get it, what it's like to be working on a computer and to be, you know, 30 milliseconds away from any other computer on the internet. You know, at the time, we would work a bit with some of the Bell System folks, and they were thinking about, you know, T1 lines and direct conferencing between one computer and another, and we're like, going, why would I ever want to connect to one other computer? You know, I want to be connected to all these other computers. And so there definitely was a feeling that this is different, and people don't quite get the difference. But it was still uncertain where it was all going to go, because there was a lot of Land Manager, and Banyan had their system, and DEC had its own system, and exactly where, how it was all going to evolve, it was not completely clear that TCP/IP was going to take over the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, back in those days, I was working on DEC systems,
right.
And so we had DECnet that was linking our PDPs together, and so like that, and it was a big deal. And just to connect up one computer next and get a file transfer, man, we just put, wow, first file transfer going across.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's kind of the same thing going on for you, is when you first go those connections and seeing those bits going across the wires.
Yeah, no, it's the, you know, the first furnace connectivity is just, you know, is pretty exciting. But it was definitely, it was a different world, because I think that in terms of the size, I tell the story about when my workstation that I was working on we were going to put it on the internet, and there was only a couple hundred machines on the internet, and so it's kind of exciting to have the computer you're sitting at on the internet. Nowadays, of course, everybody's, well, of course your computer's on the internet. But there was no domain name system. There was no hierarchical naming, and so there was just a flat name system. So I sent a mail message to John Postel, and I said, hey, I want to name my machine Pearl. And he goes, ah, you can't name your machine Pearl, because there's a machine at University of Massachusetts that's named Pearl, and you got to pick some other name. And, you know, so that was it. There was a single person that was deciding what you could name your computer.
And one unique name for the entire internet.
Yeah, right. So it wasn't until the domain name system got in place where it became, you know, you could name it whatever you wanted.
How long did it take, do you think, to go from being the one name to the...
Oh, I don't remember the exact sort of history. That was in the sort of mid to late 80s as it sort of moved into that. You know,
yeah, because you'd almost think that you should think about it almost immediately. You realize, hey, if I want more than 100 computers connected here, we need to have more than just
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
names.
seems like it should be obvious, but you know, I think getting big was the, you know, the a lot of folks who were working on the internet thought about getting fast, you know, getting, you know, go 1 megabit per second, 3 megabits, you know, and moving up. But there was a pretty good understanding that the problem wasn't getting fast, the problem was getting big, you know, in terms of the number of individual nodes on the internet. And
now, for most people, their connection to the internet comes through the web. Right. Now, and the web is relatively a recent newcomer to the internet world. Prior to that, we had, you know, FTP connections and Gopher connections and a bunch of other capabilities. Having been involved in the early days of the internet, do you see the web as being the forcing function, as being kind of unfortunate, and you wish some of the other technology using prior to that as having value as well, or are you glad for the web?
No, I think the web was sort of a there was a couple of sort of brilliant insights about that, and some just being at the right place at the right time. I mean, the neat thing is like I said, it was when the folks who were working on, when we were working on these internet programs, I was doing real time conferencing where you're connecting, you know, multi users and doing this. This thing about how do I actually show that I've got a computer that's just milliseconds away from any other computer. And the neat thing when we, you know, the first web pages were all list of links. You know, that was everything was lists of links. And the neat thing was you had one page that, boy, I could very easily go from one site, to another computer. And the web did a great job of bringing that home, that you really were connected to all these machines, you know, and just milliseconds away from each of them. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think when that came, it was like, okay, yeah, why didn't, you know, I looked at it and said, should have got that. It was kind of obvious in retrospect. I mean, hypertext was something that was there. Everybody was building hypertext. I built a hypertext system. It was a local help system that built on top of the Slate infrastructure, but it was a local one. It didn't pull all the pieces together the way that the web did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Slate itself sounds like interesting. I mean, I never saw it until I was chatting with you about this, but I mean, the fact you had this rich text and audio and video stuff going across. I mean, back in those days when I was sending email, it was just raw text. And if someone was doing a picture across, it came across as MIME encoded, and I had to take that MIME encoded text, paste it into a separate file, and run it through a program to bring it through. But it sounds like you actually were tying everything together.
Yeah, no, I think it was another, after I left BBN, it was probably another sort of 5 or 10 years where I felt like I had as rich a set of tools at my hands as I did when I was working there. It was a pretty capable system, despite the fact that it was about five devs, and we eventually added one tester, which is pretty. You know, it's neat that we could have delivered that, although we did deliver one version of the product where I think a menu, if you pulled it down, the product crashed. Yeah. Did nothing about special about the state. It was just if you selected that menu item, the product would crash.
That's where testers are important, right?
I have great respect for tests.
It's kind of interesting also to see that you started off with this rich tech system and now you're involved in Office, another big rich tech system. Do you see a lot of similarities between those two?
I think it's been interesting how many of the concepts that I sort of learned and built into systems sort of early in my career are still relevant at Microsoft when I'm working on applications there. I remember sort of the first conversation I had with Peter Engreve about the OneNote architecture, and we started talking about it, and immediately we sort of drove to sort of key topics about, you know, design of these systems that, you know, really I was working with, you know, throughout my career. So there's a lot of sort of consistency about the way these systems are designed even today.
I mean, you know, the problems we're facing are basically the same problem. It's just the quality of the solution sometimes can improve and leaping off the shoulders of someone else until you finally get better and better systems. I mean, I'm not sure how many fonts you had in Slate.
Yeah, fonts were a big problem. Yeah. The X Window system in particular, which we moved to from after sort of some of the early systems we were working on, has a pretty painful sort of font system underlying it. Actually, one of the first programs I wrote was a font editor. Because we didn't have enough fonts when we were on this custom workstation that we were using at BBN, and so we said, well, I'll build a font editor to write it. And that was way before I understood how hard it is to design good-looking fonts. But that was fun.
You probably didn't like bitmap fonts back then.
Oh yeah, totally. Just completely bitmap. No vector fonts. Yeah. You wouldn't. These were machines. They were called 3M machines. They were sort of 1 megabyte, 1 megahertz processor, and then you had a 1 megapixel display, mm-hmm. Which seemed like incredible amounts of resources. And now we're a factor of or three orders of magnitude greater than that.
Now, as I alluded to in the entry, one of the things that I think makes the internet extremely useful and popular is the fact that it addresses itself to more than just the geeks of the world, but mm-hmm. it actually addresses itself to the common man. Yeah. And the web being the thing that people come up to from that standpoint, I also see FrontPage as being a very big part of that story of making the web real, because mm-hmm. now you have a tool that the common man can actually create web pages with without having to get into the HTML. And you were quite involved with FrontPage early on. What was that like?
So that was sort of an interesting process. I had worked at BeyondMail, so I left BBN and worked at BeyondMail, and a couple of my friends at BeyondMail went off and started Vermeer. And I didn't quite know what they were doing because they kept things very, very quiet. But then soon found out that they were building an HTML. I understood that they were building an HTML editor, and I'm looking and going, that's great. I mean, Microsoft is going to build one, Adobe's going to build one, whatever, and how do you compete with just building an HTML editor? And so it was pretty neat when I got a demo as I was talking about joining them and sort of realized that they weren't just building an HTML editor, they were building a whole, the website as the metaphor of the thing that you're building, and page editing is just one part of it, and the link to the dynamic execution at the server. And it just wow, the numbers, the things you could do with a product like that, where there's just huge room for innovation in different areas, got me just really excited about joining up with that. And I also was the case that when I understood how they had built the HTML editor, I said, there's some things I could teach you about how to build editors. And so I was excited that I could bring some sort of direct value to that, but recognizing all the other value that they had already sort of built.
Yeah, because it continued to build on your strength. You started with Slate,
right,
of doing this rich editor word processing sort of capabilities.
Right, exactly. And I'd also sort of built a rich text editor at Banyan and whatever. So I had done a whole number of mm-hmm. editors along the way. And so I was able to come in and really give some sort of guidance on the way to architect that system. And it took us a few, we were shipping so frequently, and it took us a few releases before we got it sort of to the architecture we wanted. But over time, mm-hmm. we did that.
Now, had you been doing much with HTML before this time?
I had been just playing around with it at Banyan. We did the internet-enabled version of the mail client, so I did the POP and SMTP protocol support for that, and I did the rich text editor support for the Banyan mail client. But we were just, that was just at the transition point where we were sort of viewing HTML mail as a way of sending rich text content. There were a couple other less functional ways of encoding rich text in email, and with the rise of the web, it became sort of obvious we should just use HTML as the rich text content. So we were starting to get some experience there, but it was really mm-hmm. then when I jumped into Vermeer that I sort of became deeply familiar with.
Because that was kind of a big problem with rich text, because since the internet with internet email was meant to go from machine to machine, you had no idea what machine you're going to, so it might be standard on a Macintosh, wouldn't be standard on a PC, wouldn't be standard on some other system and stuff like that. And that's where HTML then provides that connectivity between those systems.
Yeah, that's one of these issues, that just getting it standardized was critical. That each of these systems had various different sort of capabilities in those areas, but getting them all to agree that we'll just use this was what was the critical thing that enabled sort of the ability to send the rich content.
And then the flip side of that is you need a graphical text editor that can take and then convert to HTML, because otherwise whatever your standard word processor is, you'd have to expect that to convert to HTML, which maybe it couldn't, because that wasn't the standard back in those days.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. It's a hot topic actually right now, because we're with document standardization with ODF and OpenXML and whatever, is that these underlying systems have different models for what a document is and what text is and how to structure it. And the assumption that you can map from one to the other isn't necessarily true, that they have very different models that they're trying to present to the user and then how they encode the information.
Mm-hmm. And because quite often the word processors, they've got internal things that they're really trying to do and accomplish, which HTML maybe can't handle without having some special encoding going on inside. And, you know, partially that's why CSS exists, because then you take and launch on top of HTML.
Right.
Even so, there's other ways, other things you might have in a document that you might not work properly in HTML.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things you saw when Office went down the path of encoding, you know, Word documents in HTML is they needed to add a lot of additional context around the HTML information in order to carry along the semantics of the document versus just the visuals of the document. You could get the visuals pretty straightforward, but then either it wouldn't edit like it had previously edited. And so carrying the semantics is a tricky issue. And if you don't have, you're coming at it from two different models, then it becomes difficult. You lose information when you map from one to the other.
Mm-hmm. And that also gets into an issue that I know I personally had with front page when I was first starting to use it is you know, I like doing HTML in Notepad.
Right.
And then when I used to pull it into front page and then drop back to Notepad again, I say, oh, that's not the HTML I wrote.
Yeah. HTML preservation I could go on for an hour talking about HTML preservation. It's actually kind of interesting story because when front page first started In fact, you could hear quotes from Tim Berners-Lee, who the creator of the web, that he assumed that nobody would be writing handwriting HTML, that eventually everyone would go to these editors. And so the assumption is all editors work by sort of pulling the content in and mapping it to an internal representation. And then you fiddle with it, and they map it to an internal representation that makes it easy to manipulate. And then they write it out. And mostly people don't look at what got written out, but in fact, because people were both wanting to hand edit information, they expected the editor to not change anything. But in fact, not changing anything is actually really hard because you want to map it into an internal representation that's conducive to editing
and keep track of before and after shots and
right. And it's actually incredibly difficult because there's a lot of information in a hand edited HTML file about spacing and case and of tags and attributes and whether you use quotes or don't use quotes and things like that are totally immaterial to the semantics of the content and yet from a user's perspective they might be very material to the way they want edited to look So really, it was over time. Front page 98 was the first version where we started trying to do a good job about this. 2000 was a whole new re-architecture, again, trying to do a much better job. And then it was 2002 and then finally 2003 where I think we had the best preservation in the industry. But everyone always assumed that there was something in there that we did to pollute their HTML as opposed to how difficult a technical job it is not to change anything. On the top of that was the other trend that was happening, which was server-side pages that were expanded on the server side. And so what you were actually editing was not HTML, it was ASP or ASP.NET or PHP or these different server-side languages. And so there was HTML embedded with code. And so They expected us to read these pages, which aren't really HTML, and then do nothing to them, and then only make the changes. And that was—it's a tremendously difficult job, and I'm actually proud, very proud of the work the team did to the quality of the job it does now.
Now, are you sad at the moment by the fact that front page kind of doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah, so front page diverged into two products. So actually, there's I'm both. It's a bittersweet. The front page was a very damaged brand at a certain point. I think partly because it got so much success so early, and it ran into these issues of HTML preservation and other things that a lot of people and a couple other decisions. We made a decision about theming to sort of spread HTML codes and comments throughout the throughout the HTML to support this notion of theming. So you could simply make a quick change and it would change all the fonts and background colors and things like that. And so there's a couple of features we did that generated, you know, this sort of expanded the HTML and ugly HTML. And so front page as a name got this bad reputation among sort of the high-end HTML coders. And despite the fact that over the course of a number of releases, we, you know, really focused on HTML preservation and clean code and whatever, it never sort of lost that reputation. And so I think that what we did is focused on SharePoint Designer, which is, of course, sort of building on the great success of the SharePoint product, and then Expression Web, which is really focused on this high-end professional web developer. So I now have two products that are the base of one of them. Actually, three products, because the Visual Studio Web Design Surface is also based on FrontPage, the FrontPage Design Surface. So I feel good about my code lives on.
So you got three products rather than just one now.
Right, exactly, yeah, right, exactly. Right, right.
Now, where do you see the future of this web design market moving to? I mean, the same concept moving forward, or do you think something, a new problem coming up?
Well, so I mean, the dynamic of the market has been pretty interesting, because essentially we were assuming that there was going to be this sort of broad lower end of the market, and in fact, what happened is these tools like SharePoint and these blogging tools and these things that are very focused on not sort of general web editing and web authoring, but rather these very focused ways of contributing content. Really sort of took over the lower end of the space. And so essentially the hobbyist market has sort of went away, or it's you know, sort of a very small market versus the high-end sort of web design authoring market, and then these sort of website, you know, self-service website market. So that's been a theme, and that's a theme that's going to continue because it is, you know, these browser-based authoring environments are pretty easy to use, and there's a lot of technical advantages to that approach. The other sort of big interesting, you know, sort of evolution is around some of these rich internet application, you know, whether it's Silverlight or Flash-based sites and sort of how they are going to evolve into, you know, the way we see the web. And there are good things and bad things about about those approaches.
Because the whole concept is being able to embody the developer solution designer's concepts to get those things to the users,
right,
whether it's through HTML or, like I said, Silverlight or Flash or ActiveX or whatever.
Right. The difficulty, of course, is that HTML has some nice characteristics around searchability and archivability and issues around accessibility that sometimes when you build Flash sites, you don't get those benefits. It's harder to get those same benefits that HTML brings. And so really thinking about how both you can create a great end-user experience but not lose some of the benefits that sort of an HTML-based web gives you is important.
I mean, I regularly see entire sites that it's basically one web page with very little HTML code and just an inclusion of like a Flash object in it that essentially is just this black box as far as the search engine things like that are concerned.
Right, which is sort of painful for all these other different uses. So one of the interesting things is when you think about these technologies is in thinking about sort of the whole ecosystem about how these technologies interact and so I think there's still a lot of room for innovation in thinking about how these rich content types and interaction types sort of merge with these other capabilities of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Now you're focusing now on the next version of Office.
Yep.
Are you see that as an evolution from your front page work, or is it a shift in your duties?
Well, it's a pretty big shift in terms of sort of general responsibility for sort of overall development in Office. On the other hand, it's amazing how much of what I've learned over the course of 25 years or so in the industry is still relevant in terms of how we build applications and how you think about applications that interact with remote data and what's the proper way to structure them so that you can create responsive applications. That's an area that I've been working a lot on is how you design applications so that they're always responsive and don't hang on interacting with remote sites.
So that the user is never really aware of the fact he's using a program that someone wrote that might have little paths that needs to go in stitches. I want to write a document, I want to access files, and bang, it's...
Right, and I think the important thing that we sort of have to realize is it's different than when you're working on a single computer with a hard disk that you know exactly how long it's going to take to read a file and whatever. When you're interacting with the internet, things are inherently... you don't know. Mm-hmm. And so you have to write the program differently, and you have to think about what the user experience is going to be as the user's waiting for that file to come in, and the error conditions are different, and you can't just make it transparent or ignore it. And I think we need to do a better job there, and we're going to do a better job. So we're pretty excited about some of the things we're doing there.
Well, enough talk about work.
Okay.
Let's have some fun. Now, I understand that you've got an outside hobby of playing what they call Ultimate Frisbee. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, I know nothing about Ultimate Frisbee, other than the fact there's a Frisbee involved, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And it's not an Ultimate Frisbee, but it's just a Frisbee you're playing this Ultimate game with.
Yeah.
So what exactly is
Ultimate
Frisbee?
Okay, so Ultimate Frisbee is a field sport. So it's played on sort of a football field-sized field. 7-on-7, so there's 7 people on one side, 7 the other. You can't run with the disc. You have to throw the disc to one of your teammates, and the goal is to throw it to one of your teammates who's in the end zone, and you score a goal when that happens. And the other team is trying to knock down the disc or intercept it. And as soon as it's turned over, the other team is going the opposite direction. So it's a lot like soccer in that respect, where you go back and forth very quickly. So it's a very active sport, lots of running. It's a great sport. It was invented about 10 miles from my home. So I've been playing.
Not your home here in Seattle.
Not my home in Seattle, but my home in New Jersey, where I grew up in New Jersey. To my everlasting regret, my younger brother actually played on the original, parking lot field where they used to go play on Friday nights, and he actually was the one who really introduced me to playing Frisbee. He actually went to the mythical first field. But I learned it in high school, and then went to MIT and played there, and then the team at BBN. I was very lucky in playing with a bunch of it was the corporate league in Boston, and a bunch of the players that I started playing with ended up going on to join some club teams and ended up winning, world and national championships. And so I was lucky enough to play with some amazingly good players. I still play. I played 4 times this week. So,
oh, really? Wow.
So
wow.
I still play regularly.
Even this wet weather?
Actually, Seattle's a perfect temperature for it. You can play year-round. So.
Now, so is it a, like... cackle style game?
No,
okay.
No.
When you're talking about parking lot, I'm thinking, oh, that sounds like
right.
The football.
Yeah,
it's like
there's no contact. There's a thing called the spirit of the game, which is that you don't foul intentionally, you don't do something that's likely to injure someone. So it's very different than other sports. Even at the highest levels, it's self-refereed. There's no referees. You call your own fouls, and you'll have interesting...
Obviously, it's not a professional sport.
Yeah, right. Well, you have interesting things where you have these very high level, the finals and nationals, and the crowd will be surrounded, and somebody will make a foul call on the field, and the crowd will boo if they think it's the wrong call, and the guy will go, okay, I'll take it back. And so it's this interaction with the crowd and this notion that you're supposed to be sort of respectful of the other team. And it's a great sport. It's a great sport for kids. I coach my kids, 2 younger kids, middle school team, and always working to make it a bigger, mm-hmm. bigger sport.
What are the things you do for fun besides programming and Ultimate Frisbee?
I ski. So I do a lot of skiing. I have a 16-year-old son who has recently totally passed me and dominates me on the slope. But I like to do that. I like to read a lot, and we have a place out at Lopez Island, and go out there.
You mentioned a couple different sons. And how many kids do you have?
So I have a 16-year-old boy, a 14-year-old girl, and an 11-year-old boy.
So you're getting your start on that 14-kid family, right?
Yeah, no. I'm done. Three's a good number.
Yeah. Now, you're saying that from experience of being a child of 14 kids, or just?
It was great growing up with 14. You know, it wasn't, you know, at the time, there was all these, you know, it's cheaper by the dozen, and yours, mine, and ours, and whatever. And
the Brady Bunch.
It was never like that. It was much more, it just seemed much more, it was normal.
You weren't building volcanoes in your back patio and stuff like
no,
that.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was pretty normal. I think the one sort of odd thing was, you know, we only had two cars, and so that was back in the, you know, 60s and early 70s and whatever, and you used to just pack kids into cars, you know. You can't live like that anymore. You'd be arrested going down the thing, you know. You have two people on the back, you know, that, you know, how those cars used to have the back thing to lie on, and you put two kids back there and
just start shoving them in.
Right, you know. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Now, here at Microsoft, a lot of people, especially when you've been here for a while, you have a tendency to, you know, I suppose, collect things in your office like that. And when I stopped by your office chatting with you, I noticed you had a nice collection of things in your office. So we actually took a little tour of your office, and let's take a look at that.
Okay. Let's see. I have, right over here, I have my... poster I got at the end of my BBN tenure career, showing all the different products and projects I worked on, little snapshots from that. Let's see, here we have a Buckaroo Banzai cup. I'm a great Buckaroo Banzai fan. I'm not sure everyone knows what Buckaroo Banzai is, but laugh while you can, Monkey Boy. There's a whole number of lines from that movie that you can live your life by. Famous boxing gloves after this I was given to from a PM who I worked on with a number of features, and we used to have long drag out fights about the design of the feature, but in the end we respected each other. This is the oldest book here, and this is it's the Bell System Technical Journal. It was the first combined journal about the Unix time sharing system, and my dad gave the introduction to this, and I grew up on Unix, so I have a big Unix background.
Well, I think I saw at least one Frisbee in that office shot. Yeah, I'm sure you had a few more.
Five of them.
Now, before we pass over to the audience, get some direct questions from them that you're going to answer, we've got a few questions we like asking all of our guests and just kind of see how they respond to it. Right. Don't worry, it's not a test.
Okay.
So there are no right or wrong answers.
I like tests. That's okay.
The first question is, what advice do you have for people in your field?
I would say one of the things that I've seen, if you look at people who have been sort of very successful, I think one thing you see as a pattern is that there are folks that have become experts in some area. They've become or the expert, you know, whether it's the expert in the way Word works or the Excel Calc engine or the, you know, the various other parts of our systems, that you need to get a deep expertise in some area. And so I think actually devs have a tendency to want to stay in one area very long, and you know, and certainly my career shows that. I was at BBM for 10 years, and but if you don't get that deep expertise, I think you don't get the respect from the people you need to be successful, and I think also you learn something when you go deep about the design of systems and how to construct systems that you can't get from just sort of a surface knowledge. So become an expert at something, I think, is important. I think another sort of take on that is also that in virtually anything you work on, if you're not sort of successful in that, you know, every once in a while you hear somebody saying, well, it wasn't a good, you know, opportunity, or it wasn't interesting, or it was a boring task, or whatever. And certainly what I've discovered through my career is actually some of the boring tasks are the ones that end up being sort of the most interesting ones, because you say, boy, if I'm going to work on this, I better have come up with an interesting solution to this boring problem. There's sort of lots of examples where you end up doing some of the funnest stuff on a problem that initially looked like it was uninteresting.
Mm-hmm. I know for me, I always like string parsing for some reason. And string parsing sounds really boring, but I like getting into strings and, you know, figuring out those equations and figuring things out from that standpoint. It's like owning the problem.
Yeah.
So how would you describe your work to someone who's not technical?
Well, I'd say, first of all, I have somewhat easier job in the sense that working on office, sort of, people sort of understand what office is, and so there's a certain familiarity with that. So that makes my describing at least what position I have as easier. And of course, the other reaction you get is they say, "You mean you're doing another version?" You know, you get two versions. One is like, "Aren't you done? I mean, when are you going to be?" And then the other reaction you get is please tell me you're not done. You know, that there's definitely there's people who see opportunity for improvement, and we see lots of opportunity for improvement. So at least in terms of what I do, it's pretty easy to get that because of office is pretty well known.
Mm-hmm. And then also, probably people all know you work in office, and every time they call you, they end the call off with, "Oh, and by the way,
how do I do this?" Yeah. Yes, you get a little technical support. Yeah. I get those from my family every once in a while.
And with that large family, you probably kind of build and build. Yeah.
Yes, right. Exactly.
In life, what would you compare producing software to?
So I like to, let's say, I would say building good software to architecture. You know, I think they're, when you think about how to sort of modularize something and have it sort of broken up well, a program broken up well, then you can think about how sort of the good design of a house or something. I think architects maybe have it a little bit easier because if you snake a cable through the, you know, you can do that in programming and it looks really ugly. It's a lot more obvious that it's ugly when it's an architect doing something. Well, we put a tree line or a zip line down here. Maybe that's a little more obvious when you're designing.
They just heard that with a gargoyle or something like that.
Yeah, we do that in programs all the time, and it's really bad. I think the other thing is I like to, I think good programs are beautiful things. I mean, there's an aesthetic to programming that I think sort of matches, I think, the sort of aesthetic of sort of designing a building. You have to, if you don't have that aesthetic, you're willing to lump things on, and I think you end up building sort of complex, fragile systems.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that architecture shows through that? I mean, in architecture building, anybody walking by can see that, whereas like the architecture of office, don't you actually have to see the code and really understand how the routines are interacting?
There's certain, but I guess I'm sort of relating it to the person who's deep in it, who's involved in it, is looking at it. But you're right. I mean, that is one of the advantages of architecture, that you can sort of, it's laid out there. And I've always, thought we need to do a better job of how do we visualize our programs. You know, just reading through a flat listing is a difficult way to get a real understanding of whether it's been sort of broken up nicely. There's various research projects that have done some work to think about that, how to explore sort of the visualization of a complex system. Mm-hmm. That is sort of one of the difficult things. But I think the basic aesthetic of building a nice system and designing a building or whatever feels similar to me. Mm-hmm. I've had good roommates and others that are architects, and there seems to be similarities there.
Mm-hmm. So finish this sentence. You know you're a computer nerd when?
When you're so excited by the algorithm or data structure you just designed that you go and tell your spouse about it and try to describe it to her. And then you find, maybe I need to find somebody else to talk to about this. There's definitely been a number of times where I said, this is so cool. I need to go, I really want you to understand this.
It doesn't quite work, right?
It doesn't take much. My wife's a smart person, but she's not a computer programmer.
Does she get into computers much, like, HTML?
Not HTML. She's she's very techie. She's almost sort of more techie with me with new devices and other things that she always wants to jump on quickly from that perspective.
She's more of a technophile rather than a techno-enabler or something like that. So lastly, what we do is take and ask everyone to draw and explain your favorite data structure.
Okay.
So we're going to give you the opportunity to check out your artistic skills.
Okay, which are very bad. So anybody who knows me would be stunned if I didn't pick a gapped buffer as the thing. So I'm gonna go ahead and do that. I'm gonna pick a gap buffer. Gap buffer is a data structure that I first learned about in reading about the Emacs text editor, but it's usable in lots of other cases and has some interesting sort of characteristics. My drawing here is goofy. It's an interesting data structure from another number of perspectives. So here's my attempt at drawing a gap buffer. So the idea is, of course, one of the simplest data structures in computers is just an array. And so you start off with an array, and then a common thing that people want to do is build an extensible array. So what you do is you allocate some large amount of data or some amount of data, and let's call that sort of max lang. But then you're only using a smaller amount of data, let's say lang, and so that these are the locations that are actually used. And so the nice thing about the extensible array is that you can add new elements for constant cost or delete things at the end. And so a generic extensible array, typically the gap is at the end. So a gap buffer basically takes the extensible array idea and says, well, the gap can actually, instead of having to be at the end of the array, can actually be in the middle. And so what this means is that as you want to do insertions or deletions, you move the gap to that location, and then you can do insertions and deletions basically in constant time at that point. And so it's often used in Emacs, it was used as for the text buffer. So where you're typing is where the gap is, and so typing and inserting and deleting around the gap is very easy. So the nice thing about this data structure in terms of sort of talking about data structures in general is a couple things. One is it's sort of super important. Locality, it's all about locality. The performance of this data structure is all about sort of the locality of operation. And it turns out, as we think about sort of memory hierarchies and the way that even the way that multi-core is impacting things, that locality is just more and more important, in fact, in terms of designing, thinking about how our systems sort of are architected for having good locality. And then the other interesting thing about this is it's a very efficient data structure if you use it the way it's designed to be used. And it can be very inefficient if you don't do it that. And there are no perfect data structures. And knowing what the characteristics of the data structures you're using are, and knowing how to use them, is actually pretty important. And so the gap buffer is sort of a classic in that it's great for what it's designed for, but if you try to misuse it, it can be bad for you. So this is at the core of Emacs, and in fact, front page. If you look at front page data structures, they're gap buffer is all over the place, and I could go on for another hour or so talking about that.
Yeah, and you preface this by saying, anybody that knows you, you didn't do a gap buffer. I mean, why are you so known for a gap buffer then?
Well, this is, you know, the one thing is about front page. The front page, I would say one cool idea I had with front page, maybe you could come up with a few other cool ideas, but was this idea that that how do I manage selection in a complex system? Selection as in where, what area is selected to operate on, and in particular in a tree-based system, selection is typically handled by a list of pointers to nodes in the elements in the tree, and that can be very awkward and fragile in terms of as the system gets bigger and more complex, and so the design of front page was the notion that that you stick sort of sentinel characters in the underlying text buffer, and then you can use selections on that text buffer as the sort of core selection object that can be used throughout the system. And it's a very robust, performant sort of underlying selection model in that. And so I always made that big point. That was the very sort of cool aspect of the design there.
Well, it seems like, you know, you really own this data structure then. So before we go into asking the audience questions, let's go ahead and sign this for us.
Okay.
Make that permanent.
Now, typically you can't read my signature, so I tried to do a good job there.
So I mean, that's not your signature you're trying to say. Okay, so now we're ready to open up for questions from the audience. Does anybody in the audience have any questions for Terry?
What is one of the most challenging technical problems you've had to solve, and how did you solve it?
There was a really scary problem that I had to solve. Maybe I'll pick that just because it was an interesting technical problem, but it was actually sort of it was scary from a professional perspective. Because when I was working on FrontPage 98, we had shipped FrontPage 97, and then I had worked to deliver the Macintosh version while the rest of the team went on to FrontPage 98. And so I joined the 98 team a little bit later from the other development, the rest of the development team. And but that didn't prevent me from ripping up the entire core of the editor's design service and sort of throwing it up in the air. I think I went 3 weeks without compiling because I was rewriting everything. I was actually several weeks past the rest of the team was code complete and things just weren't coming together. I had this design for the display surface and the data structures and the internal data structures that I was having a tough time sort of getting to sort of working state. And so I remember I worked like every single day for you know 12-hour days, 16-hour days in that April, trying to get it going. And I went home to have dinner with my family one night. And on the way back, I sort of had this insight that I was going to back off of the what I was trying to accomplish in terms of the complexity of that data structure, and I was going to take a simpler approach. And I proceeded over the next 2 hours to sort of code that up, fixed a couple compile errors and one bug, and had it working that evening. And that's what we ended up shipping in FP98. And then in FrontPage 2000, I ended up sort of finishing that full design that I was looking for and doing it. So that was really the point where, sort of in contrast to BBN, where there was like five of us working on it and the product maybe had 15,000 users, this was, you know, FrontPage, there was, you know, a lot of people working on the product, and if I screwed it up, it was a big screw up. So
you wouldn't be here today.
I wouldn't be here today, right. So that was a little scary.
Another question from the audience, right here in front.
Hey, Terry. So Microsoft is famous for having some challenges in its cross-group and cross-division collaboration on software. Can you tell us about one of the challenges you've worked through and how you managed to get through it?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I think one interesting experience we had was around sort of the FrontPage design service and the relationship with Visual Studio. For a long time, Visual Studio was pushing the Trident-based surface, and FrontPage went down a path that said we're going to sort of own our own core surface. And there was a lot of sort of interesting discussion back and forth about what the right strategy there was. Back in 2002, we worked, and this was driven by Harley Rasnow, who worked for me at the time. We worked through with the Visual Studio team in terms of them understanding what our technology was and what we could deliver into their product, and essentially drove an agreement where we took the FrontPage design surface and delivered it as part of the Expression product and then also into the Visual Studio product. And I think that was, you know, it was a long process of getting to the point where there was agreement that that was the right direction to go. And part of it was developing the technology internally in FrontPage that really addressed their requirements. But it involved getting people on their team that thought it was the right thing and getting them sold on it. And there needed to be internal drivers there on their side as well as folks on our side who saw the value in working together. So it was critical to get the people sold on it and then but also to have the technology, the right technology choice there. So
now cross-group interaction like that can be extremely important in a company the size of Microsoft.
Yeah.
Did you take learnings from that and apply those to other similar type problems you might be having later on?
Well, I think one of the things we've seen is the importance of knowing the people and getting to know the people. I had a great opportunity in working with this multi-core virtual task force that has people from around the company, and that was a great opportunity for me to really get a chance to know those people and work with them on some deep technical problems. And I think when you sort of develop those relationships, it makes it a lot easier when you're going in where you have some issue, some product issue or a product decision to make to based on, if you can go in based on having a, you know, mutual respect for the people you're working with, it ends up being a lot easier. So those relationships are a big part of being successful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, quite often, you know, I explain to people that, to understand Microsoft, you almost have to envision as being like Silicon Valley, but up in the Pacific Northwest. Silicon Valley has all those companies out there, and we are not just one big company. We're a company of companies, and so quite often the conversations don't always flow as smoothly as you might expect otherwise.
Yeah, I think one of the it's funny when you read a news article that talks about Microsoft decided this or Microsoft decided that, and I'm going, there is no person named Microsoft. There's lots of individuals, and we had actually an interesting sort of learning when we first joined, as FrontPage. We were very lucky because Chris Peters, who had been the head of Office, took over and took over to become head of FrontPage. So he went from leading a team of 1,500 or so people to 40 people. But he was incredibly insightful. And one of the things, as we went through the first process where we go, the triage process, where we go through and make decisions about which bugs to fix and how to fix them and whether or not to fix them. And one of the things that he pointed out there was, you know, it's the decisions you're making in this room with three people, with a dev, a test, and a program manager about these that end up being Microsoft. This is what Microsoft decided. Well, it was three people in a room trying to make the best decision they could for the product, for the user. And that's where some of these key decisions are made. Mm-hmm.
And thank you, Terry, from the Technical Community Network, for being our guest today. And thanks to the audience for coming by.